they approve the version that we have signed off as EXCO to Parliament before the one that comes from the printers, because what's important is just the information inside. Yes. Thank you. Again, Honourable Chairperson Landers and Honourable Members, it is a great privilege for my team to address you today on our strategic plan. Firstly, I would like just to go through very briefly on what we are going to cover in the presentation. We will just give you a brief introduction to the presentation. Then we will go to a short discussion around what we see as some of the traditional roots of an institution such as an ombudsman or the public protector, and we have chosen the Makhadzi as one of the traditional institutions in the country. And we'll talk very briefly about the constitutional mandate, which members know about, the vision, core principles, service promise, our achievements and lessons that we've learned in the last 12 months and in the past 15 years, our strategic objectives, led by a particular planning framework. We'll talk about the budget. We will address you again, Honourable Chairperson, about the remuneration in terms of condition, for the Deputy Public Protector. And then we will be we will conclude. In terms of the from the introduction point of view, we are approaching Parliament with a revised strategic plan. Last year we presented to Parliament a new strategic plan for the office. We have now revised it. In reviewing it, we have decided, Honourable Chairperson, that we will retain our current vision, we will retain our mission, we will retain our core values and principles. We decided that the strategic thrust should just remain unchanged, but under each of those strategic actions, we have concluded that things should change. The reason we did that was primarily because we felt that our mandate remains unchanged and the operational context has not changed significantly in 12 months. And at the level of a vision, we are looking on a 10-year plane, and we don't believe that a vision should be changed every year, because then it's difficult to really measure to what extent did you travel to implement it. But obviously, at a tactical level, we have to review and look at what could we possibly do better. And that is for the reason then that our strategic thrust remains as we highlighted it last year. We have included, just for your interest, it's not really annexed to the strategy. The documents that we've included, just for interest, are documents such as the Public Protector Good Governance Week, the final report on the stakeholder consultations, and our regular report on what is happening at the level of remedial action, and the document is called In Search of Remedial Action. Other Honourable Chairperson and members, I could just talk very briefly about what was the process that led us to a reviewed strategy. As you know, last year we adopted what we call Public Protector Vision 2020, last year March, and a strategic plan for 2010 to 2013. During that year, we also commemorated our 15 years of existence and operations, and we reflected on lessons that had been learned in the 15 years. We've now had another 12 months to reflect on what are we doing, in what way is that really taking us forward in regard to implementing our constitutional mandate, and what takes us back, and what we present to you, Honorable Chairperson, is something that looks at the things that we do well, the forces that help us to move forward, and those areas where we think that we need to change gear a little bit so that we can deliver on what the Constitution wants us to do. We had a strategic conversation that was going on for the whole of last year, but that culminated in a facilitated session where we then met as all senior management, and which was this plan, people in the provinces, to discuss again our strategy, whether we're still on the right track, and to look at where do we need to shift gear. After that, the executive committee of the institution adopted the revised vision. Basically then, you say what we're presenting to you, Honorable Chair, is a product of a rigorous process of implementing the Public Protector Vision 2020 and strategic plan that we adopted last year. We have then re-examined that vision and strategic plan, and we then decided, as I indicated initially, that to retain the broad thrust. And in particular, we've decided to retain our commitment to reconcile the status as citizens. As a team, we feel that the public protector strengthens democracy by acting as a buffer between the state and citizens, and in so doing, reconciles the state and citizens. So we don't replace the state, or we don't displace government or parliament. We complement a government and parliament by being ears and eyes and by being keepers of people's tears, as Ethiopians would say, and making sure that the state is always aware of what people feel and what people need, and is able to correct that as soon as possible. Honorable Chair and members, we previously said that we have a two-pronged approach, and we retain that. That two-pronged approach entails that when we get a complaint, we immediately write each specific wrong that arises from the complaint, if indeed a wrong was committed. But at the same time, we take measures that ensure that we diagnose and remedy systemic administrative inadequacies or failures, with a view to entrenching good governance by assisting the state to transform itself so that it consistently gets things right the first time. As I go forward, I will explain how we do that. And one example is what we've done with the billing system in Joburg, where we don't just look at all the complaints, but we look at what's wrong with your whole billing system. But secondly, why do those people need to come to the public protector to be heard? So the last leg of our transformative agenda is to make sure that we don't only transform the decision-making process, we also transform the complaints mechanisms within the organs of state that we interact with. Promoting good governance, therefore, includes ensuring that when mistakes are made, internal complaints mechanisms remedy the situation promptly and responsively. In our cover page, Honorable Chairperson, we've used the symbol of Makatsi, and people may have asked why a Makatsi. We know the Ombudsman originated 2001 years ago from Sweden. We debated actually whether we should use the Swedish symbol or we should look for a familiar version of something similar to the Makatsi. In fact, we found out that Sweden, in inventing the Ombudsman institution, drew experiences from the Middle East, Turkey in particular, where there was a traditional system of someone one who has always a buffer between the state and citizens. And in our case, we looked around in KwaZulu, we found that they had a group called Amaphakathi, which was a collective of people that could always tell the leader, your people are not happy, and if you want to maintain a stable state, you need to address that. We then looked at the vendor, a group in South Africa, found that they had something that is more closer because it was one person. They have Emakatsi. Emakatsi is not really a traditional leader, is more of what the Ethiopians call the keeper of people's tears. It's a person that sits between the traditional leader and the people. And hers is really just to listen to the people and to convey to the leaders that this is the problem, and where she feels that something needs to be done differently in order to be fair and just, she does so. She tells the leader, and we are told that a leader who disregards the counsel of Makatsi is in danger of walking alone, in other words, without having the village following him. And then he has to rely on ruthlessness rather than on consensual leadership. So that's why we put the symbol of Makatsi, to say we're not really an enemy of government. In fact, when the ombudsman was introduced in England, the committee came back and told government that the ombudsman is on the same side as White House. It's just that maybe sometimes the White Hall. It's just that the White Hall didn't know that the ombudsman was on the same side. In other words, we're on the same side as government in that we're just helping government to comply with its own constitutional obligations, its policies, its laws, and its undertakings. Whenever an administration gets into power, it makes promises to citizens. All we do is to help government to remember what those promises are and how those then translate to day-to-day interactions between government and people. What we also have reflected on, Honorable Chairperson, is that we believe that the public protector has enormous potential in the area of access to justice, because we provide a system which resonates more with the efforts of our people, of the majority of our people. The average South African finds the adversarial justice system in courts alien. And we offer an inquisitorial channel where people who feel wronged by the state can engage with the state on an equal footing, and not in a David versus Goliath footing as happens in the courts. Our services are free. And we think, though, we provide a service both to the state and to the people, because then government doesn't have to lose money litigating in court on matters that could have been resolved internally. We also think that the potential for access to justice is particularly important now because we have an economic meltdown. When people go to court, they don't have the time, they don't have the resources. I always say, with government doesn't mind losing time. I don't mean government, I mean the people. This is because it's not their money. You can sit for 2 years. It's not a crisis for you. But to the business people whose cases we take to the state, and to the person whose wall, for example, was bashed by a municipal car, taking government to court would have been a very long, expensive, and tedious journey. And if they come to the public protector, those matters are resolved less painfully and with less money involved. Because I can't say it completely without money, because they do travel, they do make telephone calls. That's basically the content. Our constitutional mandate is the same, Honorable Chairperson. We investigate conduct in state affairs or in the public administration in any sphere of government that is alleged or suspected to be improper or to result in any impropriety or prejudice. We report on that conduct and we take appropriate remedial action. We are constitutionally required by Section 182(4) to be accessible to all persons and communities. And what I also need to add here is that the Constitution says the only thing that is excluded from the mandate of this office are decisions of courts. And sometimes government is confused about what is excluded. Our planning framework, Honorable Chair and members, remains the same. We see everything coming together in the form of really a house or a temple, whatever you may look at that diagram as. It has really, you know, our vision, mission, and our core values, which we have retained, 10 of them, the ones that we have we presented last year, we still think they are relevant. But we think building a particular corporate culture is important, and that's one of the areas we focus on this year, to build a corporate culture that supports, that is anchored in those values, and that supports our attainment of the vision and strategic objectives. The strategic objectives themselves are based on issues such as the need to achieve accessibility and trustworthiness through quality, quantity, reach, and penetration. The need to be responsive to all complainants through exacting accountability and prompt remedial action. 3, the need to promote good governance through systemic transformation of the state. And the need to have, within our own system now, efficient and effective business support systems and operations. And lastly, to develop within our system a culture of optimal performance. A culture of optimal performance, which is service focused and is backed by committed people. We have retained the vision, Honorable Chairperson and members, to remain a trusted, effective, and accessible public protector that rights administrative wrongs and consistently acts with integrity to ensure fair, accountable, and responsive decision making. Service and good governance in all state affairs and public administration in every sphere of government. Our mission remains to strengthen constitutional democracy in pursuit of our constitutional mandate by investigating, rectifying, and redressing any improper or prejudicial conduct in state affairs and resolving related disputes through mediation, conciliation, negotiation, and other measures to ensure fair, responsive, and accountable public sector decision making. As I've indicated, we've retained our core values and our core principles. The core principle is really we seek to ensure that there is a supremacy of the Constitution and the rule of law, and the way we interact with the state and ourselves is founded on the values of independence and impartiality, human dignity, equality, ubuntu, redress, accountability, integrity, responsiveness, transparency, justice, and fairness. In addition to these core values, our work is anchored on Section 195 of the Constitution, which is the principles of public administration, and principles, as well as these three core principles: accountability, integrity, and responsiveness. Last year, we made a service promise based on our strategic objectives, and it has these key promises. One is to be trusted by and accessible to all persons and communities. 2, provide prompt remedial action. 3, promote good governance in the conduct of all state affairs. These, as I've indicated, come from our three strategic objectives and they are the first three. They are supported by the following corporate strategic objectives. One is to be an efficient and effective organization, and the fifth one is to ensure optimal performance and service-focused culture. The next part that I'm going to go to, Honorable Chairperson and members, is to look at when we reflected, what are the key lessons we've learned and achievements. We still have 20, I think in the past year we increased our offices to 20 across the country, being the national office, 9 provincial offices, and 10 regional offices. We have a toll-free line that I'll talk about later, though, about what we're doing to review that toll-free line, because as we increase our services, it is backing up. We have strengthened our outreach, education, and communication activities through activities such as that have included the launch of the Public Protector Good Governance Week and leveraging relations with stakeholders such as NGOs, CDWs, traditional authorities, and government. We continue to have mobile office of the Public Protector Services, which is something we are looking at, strengthening and expanding to other offices, to other regions. Honorable Chairperson, one of the lessons we have learned is that there is a need to be accessible to all persons through communicating to each community directly. At the moment, most of our communication materials are very omnibus or catch-all. We are moving towards a communication strategy which we've just concluded, which makes sure that we're able to communicate to different segments of society, rural communities, and different classes, etc., because sometimes the message is missed. For example, the mainstream media thinks that we deal with high-profile cases and anti-corruption cases. The classical ombudsman functions where the office is really needed, people don't always know that, that they can come to us for a quick resolution of those things. We have learned also that it's important that it's not just enough to have information available, the information should be usable to each segment of society. And we learned that it's important that we should be able to reach every community through our geographic locations and through language. Geographic one, I'll talk later about a model we're exploring with the post office, having learned that from our counterparts in Jordan. We are forever looking at the quality and quantity of our service and the penetration of the service. Penetration meaning reaching all segments and reaching all corners of the country. One of the decisions that we arrived at, Honorable Chairperson, is that we really need a fully-fledged call center. People tell us that they call our call center and there's no answer. It's not a 24-hour call center. And there was a point where the call center operator, our toll-free operator, decided that even my office will have to be on duty. The two people in my office, she placed them on duty to receive calls and to address, to do intake, basically, to do the interviews. Because she just felt that investigators, everyone was busy and everyone had to chip in. But that was it's been a real difficult thing in terms of language, in terms of investigators have to take call center duty whilst they're dealing with very serious investigations. Previously, it wasn't maybe too difficult, but right now that we have enhanced the rigor of our investigations. That means investigators are always often doing field work, and they're doing research. They're not really just waiting for a response from government. So, yes. So that's another, that's why we're looking at the call center being overhauled, more lenient against the legal aid board's recently established call center. We're looking at harnessing stakeholder relationships with institutions such as schools and post offices to reach out to those communities. Most families always have someone at school, so if you reach out through schools, you can be able to reach communities. The post office, we are considering using them as our agent to collect the complaints on our behalf. That's something we're looking at. And it's something that we've seen that it works well in Jordan, but we are still working to conceptualize it. We have created a new unit which is called Intake Assessment and Customer Service. It's still not really fully fledged yet, but the idea is to have a separate intake component, the assessment of these cases quickly, so that if really it can be resolved telephonically, it's done immediately, and if it doesn't belong to us, we come back to you quickly instead of keeping you hanging. And then customer service. Like any other institution, it's important to us that we get feedback from customers and that customer complaints are handled immediately and effectively. At the moment, people just write to the public protector or call or then resubmit their complaint if they think it was closed prematurely. So we're having that whole component, we're benchmarking it against our counterpart in the UK, where they have a fully fledged, proper center. Because as you grow, the capacity or the risk of making mistakes in your own system happens, and with a customer service unit that becomes very important. Our early resolution unit, which we introduced last year to you, honorable members, is continuing to grow, and we've rolled it out now to the province. There's still some things to be tied today, but we're moving. From the point of view of the work we did, honorable members, we processed annually, we process over 15,000 cases, and with about 40-something or so resulting reports. And often there's a mistake where the public thinks that our remedial action is only in terms of reports. In most of the ones that we resolve telephonically or through ADR, people get instant remedial action. And if you look at our newsletter, you see that some of the stories we cover are not reported. There are actions where the staff moved in and said, please, we think you owe this person, and government agrees, and government agrees, and that's the early resolution part. We continued, Honorable Chairperson, to move with a combination of prompt resolution and systemic interventions. One of the lessons we've learned is that we're still struggling with cooperation by organs of state during investigations. Not all of them. Most of the struggle is not that they refuse. They tell you that they've been very busy. We subpoenaed an organ of state recently, and they told us that they were extremely busy. That's why they couldn't come to us. In fact, there were two. The other one came on the threat of a subpoena. But I mean, we asked them, if we are a court of law, would you want to deal with everything that you have to do? And then after a year, then think, now you can report to the public protector. Because in the end, the issues were easy to resolve, but they don't come. What I'm going to present towards the end, Honorable Chairperson, is also on the question of getting responsiveness from organs of state, particularly on remedial action. I would ask Parliament to consider making it a standard requirement that when a minister presents her annual report, she or he must also indicate what findings were made by the public protector against his or her department, and what has she done about those findings, and where she or he decided not to implement, why did she do so? The second recommendation is also, which is a standard practice, is that we're not a court of law, is that Parliament also makes it its own decision that if a minister wishes not to implement the decision of the public protector, he or she must approach the portfolio committee of his or her department to indicate that they have a problem with the recommendation. Because it's unconstitutional, and this is global, it's unconstitutional that you spend resources doing an investigation and money, people's time, and then somebody sits in a little corner for 2 seconds and comes back and says, I'm not going to implement. I think the British courts and courts all over the world have said that's not allowed. There has to be a process where you can contest the decision, and the only time you cannot implement is if the decision of the ombudsman is irrational. In other words, no reasonable person could have reached that decision. And would like people to be put to that same test. Otherwise, we're lying to South African people to say, come to the public procedure, but there are no guarantees. You come to this. They might as well go to court then. And that's basically the issue of, from our side, we're doing our part as well, is that we've finalized the rules now. They're ready. And what we decided, Honorable Members, was that instead of just going to the sunset and issuing the rules, as maybe legally we could do that, we'd rather have a session with the portfolio committee, at least one, to look at those rules. Just to engage and see whether the committee has any comments on it, and then we'll have one round of stakeholders, just one national, and then we'll move with them. But from our side, they've been concluded, and thanks to the Deputy Public Protector, who has been driving that process, and if money has. Honorable Chairperson, we really don't have adequate investigation capacity. I would like the committee to deal with that. From our side, we've realized that we really need to improve case management. Not just case management, I mean, previously, there was a confusion between what we call the case management system, the CMS, and case management. You see, the CMS doesn't manage your cases. The CMS allows you to, it's an enabler to manage your cases. So we need a system where we are working at the system, and we provided investigation guidelines on how to contain your case. How do you make sure that a case that could be resolved in 2 weeks is resolved within 2 weeks and is not resolved in 12 months? And how do we standardize our investigations to make sure that the quality of justice does not depend on who investigated this matter? We are looking at capacity enhancement through forensic skills and investigation skills. From our side, we've cooperated with the SIU, where there's been transfer of skills around forensic investigations. But we've now appointed somebody with a forensic investigation skills, who will start immediately. He has 20 years' experience of investigation in the banking industry. He will now be the chief investigator in the good governance and integrity, good governance and integrity unit. So that on its own is going to boost our capacity. We've also trained our people, and that's the ongoing on PAJA, because we think that the foundation of good administration is the promotion of Administrative Justice Act, among others, and then obviously looking at our own Act. We have developed guidelines to standardize approaches to investigations, ADR and remedial action. At some stage, we could share those with the committee, but we thought it was important. And in our reskilling, we're benchmarking against other countries. For now, we are working with the UK, as we have signed a very good relationship with them. that involved them coming here and us going there and me speaking to the ombudsman every other week, just to look at how can we learn from each other. We, on the issue of early resolution, we are looking at other countries though, such as Jordan. Jordan also has given us this issue of the post office. We have also an agreement with Canada that will be training our people on investigation skills. They've got what they call Sharpen Your Tips course, which was given to the public protector people in 2008, and we want them to come and train more people. We have a strategy alignment process that is already underway, and I've already indicated Honorable Chairperson and members on our international collaboration. All in all, we're really looking at a sustainable transformation of the state to ensure good governance and service delivery, and we want to beef up our systemic investigation and intervention. In the report, you will see in the final report that we have done a lot of interventions that don't culminate in reports. Like with Home Affairs, we've been talking to them about this duplicate ID problem. With Home Affairs, we intervened with the Zimbabwe thing, and we brought them around the table, and there was an agreement, and everyone was happy that it was resolved. With the Jobek, with the city of Jobek, we've done also the same approach where we try to mediate, and we're doing a systemic intervention. With Eskom in Bloemfontein, we did the same thing. So there's several areas where we don't really just, you know, do a long systemic investigation. We do a systemic intervention, we sit around the table, and if they work with us, we get better results. In Jobek right now, we'll be announcing tomorrow what progress has been made and what further progress is going to be made in resolving the billing situation, but not just the billing situation, the complaints management, the complaints management system there, because I think part of the problem in government is that when people complain and feel that they're not being heard, then it's a problem. We remain with the Good Governance Week. It remains one of our premier projects. Going back now to the strategy, Honorable Chairperson, if you saw those five strategic objectives, which I mentioned earlier just now, they remain unchanged. There was a suggestion that we should change strategic objective number 2 to say resolution of complaints. We thought that for now we'll stick with prompt remedial action, because that's a strategic choice, because we think that's something that's lacking in our system, and that's something that we want to drive at. Lastly, what really has changed then in the new strategy, Honorable Chairperson? In terms of strategic objective number 1, what has changed is that we are looking at the establishment of a fully-fledged call center. 2, we want to develop and implement a framework on accessibility that talks holistically about a public protector footprint throughout the country, accessibility through communication, accessibility through physical access and everything, whether we're going to have satellite offices or not. MOP can't be a pilot project forever. MOP, a part of that framework has to look at how do we cascade MOP throughout the country. MOP is the mobile service, and it's the best thing we have in terms of reaching out to the rural community. On prompt remedial action, we have resolved to establish a compliance unit, which will look at external compliance of the government, but also internal compliance. And then we have guidelines on remedial action. We have on promotion of good governance. We have guidelines on investigations. And the other thing on prompt remedial actions, we have guidelines on ADR. So going forward, we'll be implementing those guidelines. What has changed in terms of an efficient and effective organization? We've established a quality assurance unit, and a compliance unit. We have also found that, like all other institutions, our own governance system needs to be improved. So I resolved to establish a governance and integrity committee in the office itself. It has some of the senior members in the office. It's something that was agreed just towards the end of the strategy process and at our last EXCO meeting. We'll have a governance committee chaired by the Deputy Public Protector and with several members of the team coming from senior management in the office to provide guidelines on our own governance system, ensuring that we also comply with our own rules and our own values and our own promises to the public, and we comply with treasury requirements, etc. But more importantly, to also assist me when there are violations of our own governance requirements. Instead of just sending it to HR, some of those issues that are governance issues we think should be handled at the level of that kind of a governance committee. We had a choice to have an advisory committee of outsiders advising the public protector, which other fellow ombudsmen in other countries have, but we chose for now to work with this kind of office structure. We are training our investigators and we are benchmarking with international practice, with good practices, maybe not necessarily always the best, but good practices internationally. And in the coming year, we've decided that we look a lot around countries such as New Zealand, Singapore, around case management, because one of the areas that we found is the weakness of case management. That country, the stakeholder we can't see on the screen, Honorable Chairperson, but that basically is a diagram that shows how does everything that I've spoken about fit together. In the document that was provided, it's on page 20. That just shows how does everything fit together as a whole in terms of what we're trying to achieve. All that we're doing is really to achieve our constitutional mandate, which is to investigate improper conduct in every sphere of government, report on that conduct, take appropriate remedial action, be accessible to all persons and communities. That's the ultimate goal. To reach that, we have a vision which is like looking at between now and within the next 10 years, this is what we want to achieve, a trusted, effective, and accessible public protector that rights administrative wrongs. Then we have a mission and values, which is on a 5-year plan. Then we have strategic objectives that are looking at a 3-year plan. The strategic objectives are 5. And then each strategic objective logically translates into a number of strategic actions or strategies. As you can see, we have 27 of those. Of those strategic actions that will help us to achieve the strategic objectives, that strategic objectives will help us to achieve the mission, vision, and mandate. Then from the strategic, strategies, those then translate into operational plans and performance agreements. The content of those, again, is a document that is on page 23. This consistent update, where we've given you then the actual, all the 27 strategies that will focus our energy. What will we do in the next 3 years or so, but focusing primarily even its 12 years. This will then influence what we call our corporate plan or operational plan, and that will influence people's performance agreement. And then everything upwards then translates into a logical framework that helps us to achieve our mandate and our vision. Then, Honorable Chairperson and members, the next part that I want to very quickly is our budget. Our budget for last year was about 120 million for the previous year. This year it looks like it has increased, but I'm told that a lot of that money just went into paying back the money that we're owing public works for our leases. But this is our new budget that is coming from the MTEF. It's 142 million, honorable chairperson. It's an incremental budget. And for 2012-13, it's 156 million. For 2013-14, it's 167 million. I'm just excluding the additional ones. What we're indicating in the slide on the board is how that divided, how that budget is divided between goods and services and human resources expenses. You will see that the bulk of it will have to go to human resources, which explains it because we are a service organization. We don't provide goods and services. Really, our services are provided through people. We're a professional organization, so most of our expenditure will obviously go into people's salaries and benefits and training of those people as well. So that's primarily where our investment is going to. In terms of how does this budget then translate to? Okay. The budget, the allocation of the budget, the first part is we deal with about 15,000 cases. I think the narrative on the board is might be confusing, but let me just try to explain it in terms of the written part from our side. Is that we deal with about 16,000 cases per year. If you look at the budget, that means per case we're spending about 2,900 per case. I think I'll ask this the CFO later to explain the difference between the 2,900 and 9,500. But what we want to communicate to Parliament is that this is how governments normally allocate money. You say you have a public protector, and the public protector has to serve 48 million people. Then you have to look at what's your investment per person for those 48 million people. This is what this is trying to communicate. Secondly, it also is looking at what is government's investment per case. If per year we deal with about 16,000 cases, for example, we will elaborate on that later. The MTEF part of the budget is what I've just. Given is how is then the expenditure distributed according to the programs that we have. We also then tried to give you the budget as distributed between people, strategic objectives, and contingencies and capital costs. That's what we've given you, that state of the budget, which is 142,000. This is then a graph, if you can put a graph, that gives you the total budget. The money that goes into personnel, as I indicated, we're a service organization, so people would take most of our money. The money that's going to strategic objectives, and then contingencies, and some of it is going into capital costs. So you can see 66% goes into personnel, that 1% goes to strategic objectives, 2% going to contingencies, 1% is going to capital costs. How have we split the budget between strategic objectives? The objective of accessibility and trusted is taking 4 million. To be accessible to 48 million South Africans. Our target this year is 38 million because 48 million includes babies and really kindergarten people. But in terms of reaching out to South Africans, we said we want to reach 48 million and we have 4 million to do that. And if you divide it per capita, Honorable Chairperson, you realize that it's a bit of a problem. On prompt remedial action, which is primarily around early resolution of matters, making sure that people get a remedy when they need to do that, we have allocated about 3.7 million, which is 8% of our budget. On promoting good governance, in the conduct of all state affairs, we have budgeted about 7.5 million. Incidentally, we have discovered that a lot of the cases that we resolve, Honorable Chair, would have cost the state far more than the total budget that we're presenting to you at this matter consistently being taken to court. For example, in Joburg, we are dealing with the case Combined People Committee that had a problem with government about how the issue of gated communities is handled. And they've taken every matter and they've won every case in court. We have to sit with the mayor and say, this doesn't make sense. Every case you're taking to court, you're losing. And the issue is not that the court is challenging your decision. The court is challenging your failure to make decisions. And so we're working with them to bring them around the table and saving the state money. On an efficient and effective organization, we have allocated about 25.9 million, which is about 26 million. Optimal performance and service-focused culture, we have allocated about 3.4 million. In terms of percentages, 9% for accessibility and trust, 8% for prompt remedial action, 16% for promotion of good governance in the conduct of all state affairs, and on efficient and effective organization, 58%, and optimal performance and service focused culture, 8%. Honorable Chairperson, this is how everything comes together in the pie chart that we're presenting. Those are just the percentages for all these areas where the strategy is going through. From programs point of view, we have three key programs in our budget. We have the strategic direction and executive support, which is the executive office, which is my office and the deputy, and the CEO's office is taking 12% of the budget. Core operations is taking 24%, and then corporate support services is taking 28%. Which the budget then for programs is 44 million. And what we have now is a pie chart that presents everything to you, Honorable Chairperson and members, in graphic form. It's just the percentages. 64% going to corporate support services, 24% cooperation, and 12% going to strategic direction and the split between provinces. We know that honorable members are always questioning this one, and I remember last year Honorable Jeffrey questioned why there's disparities between provinces. This is how the budget is split. 10% is going to the Eastern Cape, which is 600,000. Free State 649,000. Gauteng, 850,000. KwaZulu-Natal, 600,000. Limpopo, 700,000. Mpumalanga, 650,000. Northwest, 984,000. Northern Cape, 550,000. Western Cape. I just want to indicate, though, that some of the budget that hasn't been mentioned, which goes to goods and services, ends up affecting some of these provinces. So this might not be exactly the total picture, but it is still a very small budget. In graphic form, this is what it looks like. The bulk of the budget still goes to Northwest because of the huge operations that we inherited in the Northwest. The second one goes to, the second largest goes to Gauteng, which is a huge province, and the others are more or less on the same level, which is between 10% and 11%. Our request to Parliament, Honourable Chairperson. We're still struggling with resources, and we really would like a re-look at the budget, not in a meeting like this, where maybe Treasurer can send someone to come and work and look at value for money from the office and all the institutional mandates that we have. As you will recall, Honourable Chairperson, we have the Public Protector Act, which is a traditional ombudsman mandate. We have a separate mandate on the Executive Members Ethics Act, which up until today we've never been able to complete a single investigation within 30 days, simply because I'm not able to put anyone to do that investigation. Some of them start after 30 days because it's difficult to pull people out of an existing investigation. We have protected disclosures, which often involve a whole lot of forensic investigation. Some of the protected disclosures, we have sent them to other institutions. For example, in the Northwest, we got a call from a bank clerk saying there's money that was being stolen from a municipality, and the clerk could see that there was a lot of money that was going in, and it was irregular, it was unnatural. And I asked my office to investigate. My office could not investigate, and it was sent to the Auditor General. But, you know, the Auditor General's investigative powers are different. Auditor General audits, does not investigate. So there's a limitation there. But you know, my office thought it was really just trying to expedite the process. So we are sitting, yes, a lot of progress has been done. It was proven, indeed, that the bank clerk was right. Somebody was stealing money from the municipality, and there's a whole group there that was involved in stealing the money. So that has worked, and the Auditor General had picked it up in an audit query. But we're not able then to follow through the investigation on ourselves and make sure that it reaches a proper conclusion and responsible people are held accountable. But more importantly, the money is taken back to the system. Because the AG told us they don't have authority to instruct that money be collected back from those people. Had we done the investigation, part of our immediate action could be to say that the money should be in the interim be taken back to the system. We appreciate the support we've received last day, particularly on the issue of remedial action, and we would appreciate if that support continues. I want to now move to an issue that we've engaged Parliament last year on, and in principle, a decision was reached that Parliament, the Portfolio Committee was amenable to the presentation that we made. What we want to be done in terms of the Public Protector Act is now a hand of committee that can just decide this matter and authorize that we should proceed with the payment. But what we presented to Parliament last year and to the Speaker was that the conditions of service and remuneration package of the Deputy Public Protector needs to be reviewed. As indicated on the slide, when she was appointed in 2005, she was placed at level 14, which is the chief director's level. And which was far below the level of the public protector. When the public protector appointed a CEO at the level of a DDG, he then decided that it was improper to have the deputy public protector at a lower level than the chief director, and therefore adjusted the salary to be at the same level. But what we're requesting from Parliament is a proper dispensation that reviews the package. What we wrote to the Speaker last year, what I wrote to the Speaker last year, which was given to the Portfolio Committee, was that we're suggesting that the conditions of the Deputy Public Protector be aligned to those of the Public Protector. According to the Constitution, the Public Protector is at a level of a judge. The Deputy Public Protector is a statutory appointment, and unfortunately the statute does not prescribe what the level of the Public Protector is. So it would be helpful if then the committee can at least benchmark against the position. According to the Constitution, just places the Public Protector at the level of a judge, and it doesn't say which judge. What then happened was Parliament placed it at the level of an SEA judge. And then the question of the statute then didn't deal with the issue of where do you place the Deputy Public Protector. It just determined the conditions, but without really benchmarking it on a public officer, because as we know that the public service deals with public officials, that is people appointed in terms of the Public Service Act, and the Deputy Public Protector is not appointed in terms of the Public Service Act. She is appointed in terms of the Public Protector Act. So that's why we're requesting then that this be an ad hoc committee as required by the Public Protector Act. And deals with this issue and makes a determination in writing once and for all to be implemented. One of the requests that we made in the submission to Parliament was that if possible, Parliament should look at looking at what has happened in the past, because if it's possible to backdate some of the benefits that some of the package that it will now give to the Deputy Public Protector. And basically, the submission was that this has caused prejudice to the Deputy Public Protector, because while she has been benchmarked against the civil service, she is not getting the same benefits as the civil service, such as they get bonuses, certain checks, and things like that. She doesn't get those because she's regarded as a public office bearer, like other public office members. The final request to Parliament, I have indicated its resources, Honourable Chairperson. The other thing we are presenting, the other matter we're presenting to the Honourable Members and you, Chairperson, is a request that the proposed organisational structure, which is the second document that was presented, approved. To make it easier for the committee, everything in black means it's already been approved. Everything in blue means you have previously approved it. Only what is in red is to be approved for the first time today. Why we've distinguished between red and blue is because those things that are blue, we still haven't received money. So what we're requesting is that Parliament not only approves the structure, but direct Treasury to immediately fund the structure. Because previously, Parliament just said they approved the structure and Treasury should fund, but it didn't say when. So Treasury has never found the money. What we get is the 10% increase, like everyone else, or whatever increase, which is inflation, really, but it is not dealing with the increased mandates of the Public Protector and the increased service demand. We will, at some stage, hear that we get complaints of people saying, my case has not been dealt with, and you promised prompt remedial action. And Honourable Chairperson, I can say here without the fear of contradicting myself that I have a very hard working team. I have a very dedicated team. but they can only do what is humanly possible. At the moment, the amount of work they have to do far exceeds the number of people that we have. So that's why we request both the approval of the strategic plan and the request to Treasury to find the money. And then the other part is the part where we are requesting that Parliament should play a more visible role in monitoring state compliance. And the specific request that I have made today, there are two, Honourable Chairperson, in terms of Parliament. One is to request that it be a standard requirement that each minister presents, when they present their report, they must indicate if there were any findings against them by the public protector and what they did with those findings. Two, where a minister or organ of state chooses that they think the decision of the public protector is irrational and they therefore would like not to implement, would like them not to sit in the little corner but to approach Parliament for a debate, where Parliament can okay it, and it's been done. Parliament can okay it and say, we note what the public protector found, but in these circumstances, it's okay that you should not do it, or you should implement half of the decision. That's the request that we're making on the agenda. Finally, I really would like to thank Parliament for the continued support and guidance. Thank the people of South Africa for the trust and cooperation. Organs of state, particularly those that do comply with investigations, helping us to provide prompt responses and the appropriate remedial action to people. The media for continued highlighting of both our successes and challenges, and fellow oversight agencies that have assisted us in some of the investigations. Agencies such as Auditor General, where they have assisted us in some of the investigations. SIU, which has assisted us and lent the office its forensic capabilities. And our promise going forward, Honourable Chairperson, is we would like to focus this year on good quality and good time in placing. It's taking a bit of time because of resources, but it's also we're changing our mindset, we're changing our skills to make sure that we're always doing both good time and good quality. We continue to be committed to making a lasting impact on good governance through transforming the way government makes its decisions and delivers its services, and to transforming its complaints resolution mechanisms. That's what underpins our strategy. Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you, Honourable Members.
Thank you. We will go straight into the questions, clarity, and then later stage comment and discussion. Mr. Jeffrey first, followed by David Schaefer.
Chair, thanks, and thanks to Public Protector for her report. At the outset, let me say that, look, I think that, you know, what I'm generally happy with the way the Public Protector is working, and the performance of the Public Protector's office, and things like the fact, you know, you're doing fine as far as unqualified audits and other issues that we look at, such as staff vacancies. Yours, I think, was last year about 4%, so that's going fine. But having said that, I think there are some issues that I would like to highlight. One of which, and I think it's from both sides, it's not a one-way criticism of the Public Protector, but I think that there are a lot of areas in terms of the relationship between Public Protector, Public Protector's Office, and this committee that needs to be improved. So, for example, I raised concern earlier on around the late submission of documents. One is meeting the new strategic plan for the first time this morning. While the public protector was presenting, Mr. Romano had to give us copies of the addendum, extract them from members of the public protector's staff. They were not given to us, so he had to go that side and collect for members of parliament. That addendum, as the public protector herself has referred, contain matters that she wants us to agree to, recommendations that she wants us to accept. Now, really, we can't work like that. We need to get documents in advance. We need to have time to study them, to reflect on them, to cross-reference that kind of thing. So I think that's an indication of problems. Then there are issues that we raised in our budget review to be honest, everybody else, I don't know if you got the our budget review report, but just haven't been responded to. You're excused in the sense that other, the Justice Department, the Human Rights Commission, similarly didn't. Luckily, Treasury did. They responded. But I think the bottom line is we need a more effective relationship. We maybe need to set aside a day. Maybe we need chairperson of the committee to go to the public protector's office. Maybe that's a better place to do it. To look at the interaction, and then also involving the section from the speaker's office. But that's a general concern, and I really don't see how, Chair, we can approve these recommendations when we're just sort of seeing them for the first time, and in any event halfway through the meeting. There's also another issue that I'm not, the fourth point on page 3 of the annexure. Parliament approves all recommendations in the body of the report. I'm not sure what those recommendations are that are referred to. Are they recommendations in the strategic plan, in which case I can't find them? Or are they, where are those other recommendations? But we need to be clearer on that. Then look, just turning to the issue of finances, here, Public Protector, I'm not sure if you're being clear. Your budget, according to the figures we've gone up, has increased by 28%, 28.8%. 114 million the previous year and 142 million now, and that's 19.5%. 25% increase nominal and 19% in real change. And then I see that as a result of the budget review report, you did get additional allocations from Treasury. And then it's difficult also, there's a general shortage of money. Human Rights Commission had less money than you. If one looks at their rentals, it's one of the things I noticed. I don't have the figures in front of me. Their rental is considerably less than yours, which I don't know whether that means they're occupying less expensive offices, but it could be. But it doesn't help Public Protector that where we get given then, right at the end of your presentation, we get given a copy of the presentation, and it's enclosed in a folder. Okay, now that's a waste of money, a complete waste of money. And then the huge team that is here, the Human Rights Commission bring a skeleton. I know you explained in the beginning why, but still, this is a huge amount of expenditure as far as flights. I don't know how many of the members here flew business class. I don't know if I can ask, but only 3. Okay, I think with the Human Rights Commission, none of them do. So, but you know, and if the idea was to let the members of your staff see what's happening, maybe it would have been better to have said to us, look, we want more of an engagement. Can't you as members of parliament come to our offices and interact with the staff? Maybe that would be cheaper. One other point, sorry, I should have raised it earlier. When it comes to the interaction with parliament, the rules, I don't think we've had any interaction on the rules, have we? No. I you know, public protection, when you started, you went for stakeholder consultation. And if you remember, I complained about being left out. You invited Ms. Michaels, who's no longer on this committee. I think you invited her wearing another hat, but you didn't invite the committee. I think she went from a party point of view. And then when it comes to these documents, which are very interesting, I'm seeing these for the first time. I would have expected members of parliament would have been given copies of your publications. So I think there's a gap. Communication, a gap. I'm sure it's on both sides. There's more we can do as well. So it's not only pointing at you. But then going on to the budget. I raised, I think there are areas that you could cut costs. I'm a bit concerned about your offices. You've got the pamphlet here, which is out of date because it has 18 offices. It doesn't have Puta de Chava and Umtata. So they're here. But my concern, Chair, is that in that sort of section, I think we call it the Kalahari or whatever, the public, of the 10 offices, regional offices, the public protector has 3. There's one in Kuruman, there's one in Freyburg, there's one in Upington. Okay, whereas with the Free State, you've just opened now the office of Puta de Chava. So that's I think Kuruman and Freyburg are northwest. Upington is Northern Cape. But I can't find another regional office from Mpumalanga, and Limpopo, which is quite vast, has only got one. I mean regional office apart from the provincial. So I'm worried about that. I see what you're saying in your chart about the legacy of the and Chair, I think you know of it, but for other members of the committee you might not. The Botswana, for all its problems, the so-called independent republic had an ombudsman that was taken over by the public protector. But I'm not sure that 17 years after the end of Botswana, that we should still be finding in your budget that this huge amount of money is being spent on the Northwest. I don't know if these offices in Kuruman and Freyburg are linked to that, but if they're not, it just seems as though it's carried on. You know, it's not right that KwaZulu-Natal is the most populated province. And it has, apart from the Northern Cape, which is not even, I mean, I don't think the population of the Northern Cape makes the population of Pietermaritzburg, let alone Durban. But that's not right. One also gets the sense that you've got an office in Newcastle. Was it correct to open in Puta de Chava? They're not that far from each other. Maybe I'm on the wrong point in that point. But are you looking properly at an accessibility spread? Do you need more offices? Government has, municipalities have places. Government also has the Tusong centers. Maybe a sort of touring group in each province going to having a service level agreement with a municipality. Say, look, on the 15th of each month, or the 13th of each month, or the second, first Monday of the month, we will be at Kuruman, okay, from 4 o'clock or from 8 o'clock to such and such a time. So you can then, because you're traveling, you can then reach far more people. than having an office, and then you're restricted to the people. So if you take KZN, okay, it's good. Newcastle, Northern Natal, KZN, there's nothing there. But then what about the poor people in Mpangeni, Richards Bay, Mfolozi, Kihlue, Kwangwanase, etc.? They've got no one to go to. It's too far. Now, if you came to the municipal offices once in a while, you could actually cover the province without having to then pay more rent. So I don't know if you've looked at that area enough, but to my mind, those are some of the things that you could do. The last point I really wanted to make was just the issue of, and it goes back to the first point of the interaction between the Public Protector's Office and Parliament. I mean, I think that's something we should debate. I think I support you on it. I agree with it. I think the only issue for me would be maybe if you were to, instead of us asking ministers, what reports, what recommendations did you have from the Public Protector, and what did you do, rather for you to say to us and compile a report at the time of the budget process or the budget review process. These are the reports that we've, the recommendations that we've made against ministers. These are the ministers who have not responded. So we're able to actually put, rather than giving departments a chance to wriggle, that we have it from you. We have the full report from you that look, you've had all these complaints with Home Affairs, you're now having to take them to court. As it happened in the past. So but for that something, Chair, I would suggest that we resolve in discussion how best to go forward, and then also with the unit from the Speaker's office. But my fear that, well, I suppose what I'm saying is maybe you're not going far enough in terms of what you're asking us to do. Because you ask us to ask a minister in the budget process, the minister then gets an official to compile the information. Maybe that information's wrong, and happily wrong for them, as it were. No, we don't have any outstanding recommendations, whereas you feel you do. And we can then say, well, the Public Protector says you've got an outstanding recommendation and you didn't implement why, that kind of thing. So, Chair, those would be my comments. There are some issues in this. There is now a report from the researchers, which we got while the meeting was in progress. I see it's dated the 11th of April, which was Monday. Today's Wednesday. I'm not sure whether we had printing problems or photocopying problems, but it makes it very difficult. But there are some issues there that I think need to be looked at. One of them is these protocols that you spoke about before with organs of state, City of Tshwane, Compensation Commission, how effective have these, you reported on that last time, how effective have these protocols been. But I think there are issues in this document that it would be useful for the Public Protector to respond to maybe in writing later.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and thank you to Honourable Member Schaeffer and Jeffrey for the questions and for the comments. To Honourable Jeffrey, thank you for the general support of our performance. The issues that you've highlighted, Honourable Member, I think are important to us. The suggestions about how we could solidify the relationship are welcome. On the issue of documents, I did indicate, Honourable Jeffrey, that my office was informed that we have to submit 7 days before. So that is how things, there may have been a misunderstanding. But again, I apologize that if we met that deadline, that was inadequate. But we are happy to go for a reviewed deadline, because it is true that we would like honorable members to engage with the documents and to support them. It's not helpful when honorable members are not engaged. But I would still request honorable member that you do consider at least giving us an opportunity to explain the organogram, because there aren't many changes. The black part of the organogram is the structure that has been approved by Parliament long ago. That's the black part of the organogram. The blue parts of the organogram were approved by Parliament a while ago. The only thing is that we've never been able to get the money for them. The only parts we are presenting for an additional request is what we have marked in red. That's the only part of the structure that is new, but it's built into the strategy. For example, if we're talking about compliance monitoring, what we initially did was we used our knowledge management unit to do compliance. It didn't work, because these are our researchers that do hard research work on everything that we do. Now we are asking them to also find out whether Minister Mthethwa has complied with that, whether the presidency has now given us a response to that. We need a dedicated person that can just follow up on implementation. So, but I would really request, humbly request, honourable members to just allow us to try and motivate the parts of the red parts of the addendum. Again, on submitting the written part of the presentation, we apologize most sincerely and undertake to make sure that we don't find ourselves in that situation again, honorable members. On the budget that you say the budget has increased, honorable members, by about 28%, I am going to ask the Chief Financial Officer to explain. A lot of the increases of what looks like an increase over the years was covering already, like a lot of the budget went to OSD. So that doesn't really expand capacity. It makes sure that we pay people at the required level. But I discovered recently when I went back to my old institution, which is the South African Law Reform Commission, but actually we're not even doing OSD. That's why we're losing investigators. Our OSD is not really fully compliant with the government's OSD. In fact, the Auditor General has said that we need to review it. So even that part of it, we still need more money for OSD. So, but a lot of money went into that. Some of the money, honorable members, went into our leasing. We had a leasing backlog with DPW. But obviously what happens is that then once we have dealt with that problem for that year, the coming year, then the budget doesn't decrease. But I will ask our Chief Financial Officer to explain that. But I do believe that we have a budget of about 140 million for a fully fledged institution that operates like a ministry on a budget of 140 million. It has to be that. But you've raised very important suggestions, honorable members, around how we could look at doing more with less, which is something that we're trying to do every day. Like honorable members don't think we should bring the folders. We thought we would bring it in an elegant way so that we don't give you a piece of paper that you will throw away when you get back to the office, because you won't know where that piece of paper belongs to. So if it's in a folder, you'll keep it in the public protector folder. So it's really just what we do. But I think we appreciate if honorable members would have preferred a flying piece of paper that they would probably file later, because they are more diligent than we thought they would be. But we take that, honorable. You know, you learn every day. You know, you think you're giving, you think you're presenting as professionally as possible, but yes, it's hard times, and tough times require tough measures. So I think we take that, honorable member. On bringing our members here and the classes on which we flew, again, I did explain why I thought my team needed to come. This is a once in a while thing. And it's really cost versus benefit. Had I thought, though, of the suggestion you're making, honorable member, that it would be cheaper to take honorable members, it really is. It probably would be the same amount of money, but it wouldn't be to our bill. It would be to Parliament's bill. So, but I think going forward to build a relationship, if the committee can visit, I think our staff would be like supremely honoured to see members of Parliament coming to the office. I think it would be a pleasure to have that. So I think we would take you on that. Again, it's really a growing relationship. I think we've always had a good relationship with the committee, but, you know, whenever we engage and there are new suggestions, we're happy about them. On the rules, honorable member, you are right, we haven't engaged with it. That's why, even though we had these rules finalized, I decided, even though some of the members of the team were very unhappy with me about that decision, I decided that we can't just pass the rules without taking them to Parliament. And that's why the rules are not going forward, because we have requested, and during my speech, honorable members, that we should submit the rules, and there should be a day on which we engage with the rules. So that has been the decision that I have taken, rightly so, because the committee, those rules are not supposed to harden relationships with the state. They're just supposed to be like guidelines around how do we manage the interaction, and any views that we can get from honourable members would be much appreciated. The split of offices, that is not even, honourable Jeffrey, you raised that last year. And I did mention it again in my presentation. I think you were outside. It's something that we're working out, both in terms of the split of the regional offices and making the budget more even. That's why in our presentation, we were talking about what really has changed. One of the things that we are working at is a framework, a comprehensive framework on what do we mean by access. Access in what way? Access through what means? And that document will decide what kind of footprint do we want. Will it be a footprint that expands regional offices? Will it be a footprint that expands MOB services? Would it be a footprint that includes satellite offices? And in my presentation, I mentioned the post office as one of the areas that we're exploring about possible counterparts. And the Tusong centers were also mentioned to us. When we're doing stakeholder consultations, the people from Tusong centers suggested that we could use their centers as well. So it is something that will be discussed in this framework. I think once we have worked on this framework, I think in our strategic plan with the timeline on which we will have that framework, I think what we undertake now is that we'll present it to the portfolio committee so that it can also engage with us to look at, in their view, what does accessibility mean in terms of our communication system and our facial contact. I do believe, though, that facial contact is extremely important, because we have a fairly unsophisticated community. When you raised this question, honorable member, last year, I indicated that the views we got from communities was that
the mock services are fine, but they're not very happy with them, because mock services mean you have to remember when is mock coming. If mock is coming on the last Friday of the month, then you better have a problem that will materialize on the last Friday of the month. And if it doesn't, so that's why we're trying to look at something that could be permanent, like maybe the post office could be permanent. They could lodge a complaint any day of the week. But I think this whole document is going to look at all of those things. What I can assure Parliament about is we will look at the most cost-effective way we can comply with Section 182(4) of the Constitution, which is to be accessible to all persons and communities. I thank you for supporting the idea about the accountability of ministers, and I think the issues that you have raised, the Honourable Member, are very valid, and I think there is a middle ground. What I think might be possible is, why can't we have both? For example, with the Auditor General, it's both. We account on our own, which places accountability on us, and the Auditor General issues his or her own report. That's what we're trying, why we want to institutionalize it is that we think it's important for government to just know that the public protector or the ombudsman is an institution that supports Parliament. Ultimately, you're accountable to Parliament. So you can't just sit in a little corner and decide you're not going to implement. So that's the spirit in which that suggestion is being made. But thank you for those very valuable. To Honourable Debbie Sheffer, you asking about the additional allocations from Treasury. I've partly explained the issue. And then about the provinces, the budget for the provinces talks about the bare essentials that will be done exclusively from the province. But a whole lot of, there's still some benefits that they will get from national. If we take, for example, the training budget, it will look like the training budget is national, but that budget will cover everyone across all of the 273 offices in the country. The salaries budget is national, but it's for everyone among the 273 people. But I'm going to ask between the Chief Executive Officer and the Chief Financial Officer to respond to both honourable members around the issues of the budget, primarily the additional. What have we done with the additional money that we got? Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Public Protector and honourable members. First of all, I just want to indicate that last year our real budget was 114 million. Although we are supposed to get 124 at the METF, that we did not get. After the elaborate submission we made to the portfolio committee regarding the increase of budget, the portfolio committee made a recommendation, which we really thank you for it, in the report, where you indicated that Treasury should increase the investigative capacity of the public protector. Out of that, we received only 3 million to increase the investigative. Even if honourable member just can look at the report that was presented, I mean, it was so elaborate. For instance, the respect of justice as to exactly what they must get, and as well as to the Human Rights Commission. With us, it was just one sentence, increase capacity, that's it. So the only thing that they could give us was just 3 million. What we have done with that 3 million is simply immediately we got that notification. We consulted with the members, with the public protector and the members in the provinces, and we also look at the cases that are coming out of the provinces, and decided that at least only 9 investigators will be coming out of that. We duly advertised for those posts spread around various provinces and head office, particularly the integrity unit, which needed more capacity. So we have received the applications. We're in the process of filling those vacancies pretty soon. Only 9 investigators came out of very junior staff as well, out of 9 million. The other 2 million that we received was in respect of the conditions of service. basically salary improvement as a result of the increase which the government had negotiated with the union. And then the 13 million that also is added in is simply the amount that public works used to pay on behalf of us for our rental. Now it's been allocated to us, it's now that we pay. In real terms, the only amount that we got was only that 3 million, which if we include with the public works and the salary improvement, translates to only 15 million. So it may be somehow be misleading to the members that it receives a 28% increase. We lost only 3 million to increase, specifically to increase investigative capacity of the public project. With regard to the issue of the Northwest, I would definitely like the CFO to elaborate what we have done to try and correct that anomaly in terms of the budget.
Thank you, Chairperson and members. With regard to the allocation to a cost of goods and services, annually, as a baseline, this year, we have only managed to increase the budget by 1.5%. That is the baseline. However, we take into consideration the expenditure and all other things like your recommendations. So as it was highlighted in this forum, that the allocation is not proportionally, we have decided that the Northwest office, we are not going to give it its increase over the MTF period, because we cannot be in a position to reduce. Because if we reduce with all what we have inherited, they are likely not to be in a position to pay for all the expenditure. So this year they received 984,000. Even next year, according to MTF, it's 984 right throughout until such time that it's appropriate.
If I may also add, Chair, in respect of Northwest, it's only now true, honorable member chair, that it's almost 15 years, but it's only now that those members or those employees in Northwest office are starting to retire. I think this is the point that I came about 2 or 3 have retired. We don't fill those positions. So in order to correct that anomaly as well. Thanks.
Honorable,
Minister,
thank you for the followed by
I was just, although I hear the CEO explaining what we need as budget, but my concern was just simple that every institution needs a developmental budget. At the moment we have an incremental one, and we are not able to expand, and that inhibits the growth of the service. If we have, if the increment, the developmental budget is provided for, even if it cannot meet the, satisfy the needs at the moment, but we will be able to provide or project a vision of what we believe the ideal situation with the public protector is. And that is what I was requesting as well, to summarize what the CEO was saying. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't know if Honorable question was regarding offices in the Northwest was intended to encourage you to close down offices that already exist. I hope that is not the intention, because we should be talking more about making your services accessible to more people than ever. Because first of all, I like the idea, Chairperson, that one of their goals, their approach is to ensure access to justice, free of charge. In that they also assist government in lessening the cost that come about as a result of litigation. Now, relating to that also is the question is when the public protector did say that the only state action, I think, they don't investigate. Our government are quite deficient. Now, that being the case, how do they deal with instances where a state institution or an organ of state does not implement a constitution? Are they not supposed to get involved there to ensure that the state complies without a person having to go to court again? And lastly, Chairperson, the accessibility question again. They've spoken about Tucson Center and offices being opened in places like where I come from, Tata. Tata, of course, is a city, is a town, not a rural area. It needs its service to the rural community. Millions of people still need to access their services. And the Tucson Center, indeed, some of them, I imagine most of them are in rural areas, but they are still remote to a number of people. Do they not have other centers in rural areas that they could use on a regular basis so that their services can take advantage of by people who need to move? Chronic question. The traditional authority office, what are they doing about those? Do they have any strategic problems about using those vendors? Because in my understanding, they are more easier to access than the offices you find in town. Oh, lastly, this question about this request for an ad hoc committee to the speaker, I suppose this is a question we should be answering to the advocate, Joel is here also. What has been the response of the office of the speaker to this request that there be an ad hoc committee to look into this matter? Because it looks like to me it's a matter that has been tabled for too long and nothing seems to be done about it. Who is responsible for failure to do what is necessary? Is ourselves, speaker, or me?
Unfortunately, to disagree with one of my own party members, but it's not a party position. There's one of the national roads in South Africa is the N14. On the N14, there are three regional public protector offices. Three out of the 10, so nearly a third. That's Upington, that's Kuruman, that's Vryburg. On the Google map on the cell phone, I mean, Kuruman to Vryburg, it's a national road. Looks like maybe 100, 200 kilometers distance. It is unsustainable. When we've got them, it would be nice to have, I mean, where I agree with Kosi Olumisa is that obviously an office in each town would be very nice. But where we have funding constraints, where you don't have enough money to finance investigators and some of the other staff, this is not sustainable. One of those offices must go. I mean, it would make more sense to now maybe they're both there because presumably maybe it related to Maputo Tswana. I can't remember what was in Maputo Tswana, what wasn't. It makes sense that it be because shortly after Kuruman, further on down the N14 is Upington, which has a regional office, that's Northern Cape, and that would then cover the Springbok and those areas. Because on your document, in the blue is the sort of what you say was approved and unfunded. It would be regional managers. Okay, so a saving. Save the Kuruman regional office, and that office should go. And then also with the rental, I'm suspicious of your rental. It's much higher than the Human Rights Commission. Now, obviously, rentals vary, but it's the same thing if with respect to the attitude. You know, I know Public Protector, you were joking on the documentation, but really, the folder's not necessary. Members are going to they're either going to members are going to file the document, and you don't want to file the document in a folder. I mean, I've also given back my paper bag because it can be reused. So you can decide we want this nice cardboard folder with color printing. And we want a nice office in the new building in the town, where the rental is twice as expensive as the old building around the corner, where it might not be as accessible, but we can compensate by advertising or something like that. So I'm suspicious also on the rentals. But yes, you see, I'm not sure. You're independent. I'm not sure it's again something for further engagement. Why we should be approving your organogram? Is it in the law? Are we micromanaging? Is it there? Is it in the act? Okay, all right. But then you see the difficulty I've got with approving this is I would say, do we get the chance to approve your regional offices? Because I would say, you know, cut. Yes, I mean, you know, I also do have this, there's something called retrenchment, okay, where somebody, so if you had, now maybe, you know, so I've got a bit of a problem where you're waiting for the Maputitswana staff to die off effectively, to retire. That seems to be the case, you know. Could they not be retrenched? Could they not be moved? So maybe you do have staff in Kuruman and Freiburg, which were, you inherited from Maputitswana. But I don't think you keep, well, you don't have a regional manager because you're waiting for that post to be appointed. But I don't think the staff in those offices should be kept, and the offices and the rental you pay should be kept until they retire from old age. Maybe Maputitswana employ a youngster, a 20-something-year-old. You're going to keep the office until that person is retired. In short, I mean, okay, we might have to approve, but I think it's got to be linked basically to a reorganization. And I do think a Freiburg and a Kuruman office is unacceptable. Completely. I mean, maybe even you've got a Mafeking office, you've got Rustenburg, you've got Mafeking, you've got another one somewhere. But anyway, definitely on that one stretch of road, three offices. One should go. I mean, probably Kuruman because it's between Freiburg and Uppington. But even, you know, what's the population that those offices are serving? Those areas are not particularly densely populated. And then given that you've then got it Mafeking. But definitely one of those, this, you can't justify, you can't come and ask for more money and more posts that are not funded. And I don't know how many then you would, what savings you would make from those offices. Can you do other costs? I would like to have seen, you know, what steps is the Public Protector going to take to try and save money? As I said, the Human Rights Commission, fly economy. Don't, you know, when we give us sort of quite shoddy stuff. I think we was there. Theirs was not glossy paper or the hard cardboard. So you know, you get the sense from them of cost-cutting measures. They've restricted international trips, which obviously there's a lot of international conferences for human rights commissioners to go to. They've restricted those. You know, it's interesting that you've got a international person, but you're wanting us to allow you to have a government monitoring person. I would have thought government monitoring is much more important than international. So really, what I'm saying from my side, I would have thought that Chair, we need more of an engagement on this, but we need to see some reprioritization.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and thank you again to Honourable Members Jeffrey and Honourable Member Inkosi Holomisa. I will start with the questions raised by Honourable Jeffrey on the issue of regional offices. I think the issue of having offices too close to each other is a valid point. That's why we are now having that framework that we're talking about, which will determine what we want to do in terms of physical accessibility. Are we going to look at it in terms of population size? Are we going to look at it in terms of distance or both? So you need to do that. But having done that, I do know, based on that we don't have enough regional offices. What we have done with our office in Siyabuswa, we had the same problem that we talked about, was that Siyabuswa is close to Pretoria, and yet the whole of Mpumalanga does not have a regional office. What we decided was that we want to relocate that office to closer, to more central, like Witbank or Springs. That's what we've done. So instead of killing a service, we've relocated it to centralize it. But a question was raised, which takes me to the question that was raised to Inkosi Holomisa, was already that community is used to a service. So you can't just grab it and move it, and then these ones suddenly don't have a service. So you've got to look at, if you're going to relocate the office, what do we do then? And the advice they were that we should then consider a satellite. And that's why then we want to look at a framework. So, Honourable Member, I think the suggestion is fair and valid, but I wouldn't kill it. I would look at the province, because the Kuruman office is no longer in Northwest, because the Parliament reorganized the boundaries. So that office is now part of our Northern Cape offices, because Kuruman is now Northern Cape. So the point you're raising still remains valid. It's still on N14. So Northern Cape.
They both must have the same
code. I agree, Honourable Member. We are on the same side. The Ombudsman in this case is on the same side as the Portfolio Committee. But what I'm saying, Honourable Member, is that we might want them to look at where do we take it in Northern Cape, because Northern Cape is a vast province. Our people travel often more than 400 kilometers to go and deliver a service, which is expensive, but it also means they can hit and run. There are no follow-ups. It's very difficult. I must say, one of the reasons people prefer to come to an office such as the Public Protector is the opportunity to tell your story, and that's why the personal contact is important. You would be surprised how many people I speak to per week, who all explanations by my staff or by letter, by telephone, they want to meet, they want to come. And it's part of a healing process for them to have somebody they can talk to. Yes, I think that you're right, that we're working in an economy that needs to be tight, where we need to tighten our belt. And in so doing that, I think what we'll take is the views that you've mentioned, and then look at how do we reorganize the offices in such a way that they serve more people or they're more centrally located. Then you raised the issue of I think Honourable Homesa is the one who also said we can't close offices, we need to expand them. I think I would share that view, but then say we can cover both. Maybe instead of closing the office, we can have a satellite, replace it with a satellite and relocate it. The truth is, regional offices are not enough. And Honourable Member, you're right that we only have one in Transkei. In fact, I was on a plane with a young person who said to me, but you guys only have one regional office in Mthatha. And I said, in some offices, we don't even have a regional office. So at least there is a regional office in Mthatha. But I, Honourable Member, I think we value your views about access to justice. Because I think the long-term vision behind an ombudsman institution is access to justice on matters in dealing with the state. You could also even save the cost from the courts from congestion. They could focus more on crime and civil justice involving private citizens. And if the ombudsman institution is respected and functioning effectively, it can take on a lot of the civil matters between citizens and the state and resolve them amicably. So I think we're happy with that, but we take the views about how do we expand offices while bearing in mind that the state does not have unlimited resources. What do we do with an what do we do when an organ of state refuses to obey a court order? We come in, Honourable Honourable. We do that. I think one of the first few cases I had to deal with was yes, one department having failed to obey a court order, and the business person approached us, and we resolved. But we've dealt with several of those, especially when it comes to payment of money, when the court has now said you're entitled to the money, or reinstate statement of people where they. So that matter, if we can't review the court order itself. The failure to implement a court order becomes now administrative action because the state is operating, is failing to operate reasonably. The behavior is unlawful and irrational unless the order has been appealed. And then the Tusong, Honorable Nkosi Holomisa, you also said we should seriously consider the Tusong Centers, which we will now include in our blueprint that we're working on. And the tribal offices, yes, and the traditional authorities. And thank you, Honorable Joseph. And in fact, we have been approached by various traditional leaders. We've been approached by various traditional leaders saying, please come and bring our services, because they have a captive audience. In some instances, we've done that where they invite us, they already have a meeting. But I think including in our memorandum of understanding a permanent arrangement with regular visits to those communities is something we can do, it's something that we're working on. On the question of a request for an ad hoc committee, in principle, no one in the Speaker's office has said they support the request that we've made. I think what we are requesting is that that should be done immediately, well, maybe as soon as possible, and so that at least it's just done, and we know, because that's another matter we have to budget for, Honourable Members. So, Honourable Jeffrey, it will look like our budget has increased if we get this, but it will be money that is addressing a gap. It won't really, on the figures, it might look like we're getting money. So we would love that. In fact, we had asked that it be done last year because we had intended to include it in our budget for this year, starting from the 1st of April. So without pushing Parliament, we were asking that if it could be done so that we can implement it as close as possible to the beginning of this financial year, which has already begun, Honourable Members. That's all I can say without sounding like I'm giving a date to Parliament. But it can allow us to implement with effect from the 1st of April or close to that date. It would be appreciated. And then on the issue of austerity measures, about rent, I think all I can say, Honourable Jeffrey, is that I would like the team not to be defensive on rent, to just go back and look at where are we spending. Because most of the offices, if I'm looking at the strategic plan, we already had them. Last year we only acquired two offices. One was the one in Kwakwa, Mputa Tichaba. And then the other one was the one in Transkei. What I do recall was that in Transkei we struggled to find offices. That's why it took long to find those offices. And then I suppose when the demand exceeds the supply, the rental may be inflated. But I don't want to say that's the reason, because I honestly don't know where our rental money is going to. So it's a valid question. that I think we need to look at and say, is there something we can do differently? When a certain deal is coming to an end, can we review that? But if you ask my question, Honorable Jeffrey, the question I'm raising about rental does not just apply to my office, it applies to this government as a whole. In fact, what you're complaining about with us is probably a drop in the ocean in terms of how much government spends. There isn't enough due diligence before a rental is opted for, but there's often even opportunities to buy. Where a building is available at a very reasonable cost, government opts for rental, and I don't understand. Even where we are, where our national office is, we're renting. I've always not understood, why do you rent when you have a permanent structure? Why don't you buy? But also with buying, we also still need to do some due diligence, though, because I have a sense that it often costs less to build a whole huge mall than it is to build a government office. That's just my hunch. We need to do due diligence, whether people inflate the cost of building and the cost of rental when it's government than it is if somebody wants to rent an office or a mall. But I think you're raising a valid question, because I honestly believe that a lot of money can be saved from rental for us as a government as a whole and be redirected towards development. So I'm not going to defend what we're doing, because I don't know what are we doing at this stage. We haven't analyzed it, and we will now analyze it and then come back to this committee about moving forward. On other austerity measures, I am going to ask the CEO and the Chief Financial Officer to look at that, even the kinds of flights that we are doing. We do have a policy on flights, but I think what you are suggesting is that in addition to all of these other austerity measures that we're doing, like for example, we've terminated cell phone contracts and put people on their own cell phones, and that's reduced a lot of money. Office plans were reviewed. Services between the secretaries are shared, which I don't think is good, but that's one of the austerity measures that came from the administration. It has created some problems in some instances, but yes, we did cut some secretaries, and a lot of senior managers are sharing secretaries. And then the question of staff attending functions. Ordinarily, we are now rotating instead of having a team. And we take fair criticism that bringing the team here was not ideal. And it was the first, and we will then consider that. But if the team, I think we submitted a document previously that indicating what are our austerity measures, but I think we will then look at the whole question of flights and international visits. Yes, I'll see
you. Just one thing, also the ESCO asked us to look at Skype instead of the travel alarm.
Yes, okay.
The only issue was the issue of security through the confidentiality for the public protector too. And look at the IT to see what can they do to protect the privacy of the control instead of walking around and driving. And if I may add what the government has said on the issues of renting, obviously the Public Works has been doing this through and through for us, and through the Department of Justice. Obviously with the review that the Public Works is saying, definitely will definitely be. And the other agent members are aware is that 5 million that you bought from public for rentals and through justice. We should have been asking justice to help us as well, which has been an audit issue, which we still haven't got. One of the staff members was already sent me an SMS which reported to the public protector that justice can't give us 5 million, but they've surrendered 45 million to treasury yesterday.
Well, if I could just make a mischievous comment, given your scathing report on the Department of Public Works, has your relationship then affected the fact that you're unable to get appropriate rental accommodation. But it's a mischievous question. You're not required to answer. There may be. Debbie.
Thank you. Jay, while we're on mischievous comments, I have to just suggest that perhaps the Honourable Jeffrey might like to give some of your other colleagues some of his advice on the strict austerity measures that he's busy implementing here by giving back bags and so on. Just quickly, giving back bags and your very strict austerity measures need to wrap off on a few colleagues if you want to say. I'll tell you that. Then I just want to ask a question, and if I may, Mr. Chair, just get an immediate answer, because that will depend on whether I follow up or not. When exactly did you get that extra allocation?
The
treasury allocation after our report.
Yeah, only 3 million in respect of, this is 2010.
Yeah, but when did you get it?
Because we got November for now, for 1st of April 2011.
That's only coming into effect now. Okay. I was just concerned as to why, I thought you received it then, and then why it took so long to actually fill the post.
No, it's only
going to be able to fill the post immediately.
Immediately
once you get
now, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was just on the office thing going to say that if you could
look at, I mean, where I picked it up was looking at, and I can't remember which document it was, but it was one of the Treasury documents, comparison between yourselves and Human Rights Commission, because you're similar bodies. And it wasn't just a small amount, it was a big amount. And it might have been both rental and levies or whatever services, municipal services. So have a look at that. I think that, Chair, look, the difficulty is we had our last, we sat, I'm not sure deadlines, but the House is not sitting for some time, or in fact the House is not sitting until after the elections. Because approval by, I don't know what the Act then says, I mean you've seen, I'm not familiar with that section, but presumably it would be the House, not the Committee, Parliament or the National Assembly. So we'd have to look at it when we come back, particularly after the elections. But therefore, you've got time, because you're not campaigning, to look at redoing. Because as I said, I do think that I do have serious problems with two offices so close to each other. I mean, you need more. I mean, we were chatting here that for example, you've got at Bishu. And it, to some extent, it covers the interior, but East London doesn't have an office, so East London people have to go to Bishu to see you. And then there's nothing at Port Elizabeth. The next office along the coast is George, and then KZN. And then from the other side, okay, you've got Mthatha, which you've just opened, and then it's Durban. You've got a Durban. What's interesting is you're not necessarily going for provincial capitals, so you've got a Durban, not Pietermaritzburg. Makes sense because it's more people in Durban than Peter Maritzburg. Then your next office is Newcastle and so on. But I really would say seriously to look at, you know, have you looked at, for example, would it compromise your independence to have a relationship with Legal Aid South Africa, whereby you know people can come to their offices to contact you, and your officials can maybe visit LASA offices on an advertised set basis, but in a sense it's sort of similar things. Maybe you think it will compromise your independence, and you might be have validity in that, but have a look at those kinds of things, because municipal level agreements, I was joking with Nkosi here who was suggesting using traditional authority venues. What happens if he wants to complain about the traditional leader? So you do have that problem. But I do think sort of traveling, have you looked at the possibility of more traveling visits? Because rather than an established office which has greater overhead, sure the traveling increases your costs of accommodation, etc. But anyway, it would just be that aspect. And then Chair, I think how the National Assembly deals with the request on Deputy Public Protector would need to be up to us. Advocate Kechwayo has said it was actually referred to the committee to the previous chair last year in June. So I think it is of some embarrassment to us. I would want to suggest, I mean, it's something maybe the committee can look at. I wouldn't imagine it would take that long to consider it. But the problem of the ad hoc committee is that would then have to go back to the House. And I would have thought we could more expeditiously deal with it here, and then by the time we have the plenary in end of May, June, we could have finalized it rather than waiting for that plenary to set the thing up, because it's not a big issue, and I think it's embarrassing for us that we haven't attended to it.
Why don't we target next week to resolve it?
Yeah, we would need to just look at, but maybe not at this meeting, what do we need in order to consider?
Well, I was going to request of your CFO to do us the financial implications. We can't ignore that. And I'm not in any way saying that we're going to turn down this your suggestions. But there are financial implications, and it's good. It's just something that we have to take into consideration. At least be aware of what they are. And that includes back pay, by the way. Am I correct, Honourable Members?
That's what the being asked for.
Yes. So if you could just put that together for us and try and get on. Sorry to just lump this one to you suddenly now, and but there is an urgency. Please, if you could do that, I'd greatly appreciate it. And then public protection, there was a time, I know, when I was served as an ordinary member of this committee, members had this quaint idea in their minds that the Public Protector's Office, Human Rights Commission, and other Chapter 9 institutions could be housed in one building. I'm not saying that's the way to go, but it's coming back to the question of why should you rent when you could just as easily buy, in fact it could be cheaper. I'm aware that Public Works has thousands, tens of thousands of buildings that they've even lost track of. And so the question, in addition to what Mr. Jeffrey and Kosi Olomisa have raised, is then why do we even have to rent? Fine, the bulk of them are in Pretoria and Johannesburg and places like that, but inevitably all departments go to Public Works and say, we want to rent that building there. You see that one. And their reason is because of its proximity to the nearest shopping mall. So at lunchtime, the staff and everyone else wants to put their pens down and take a stroll down to the shopping mall where they can have lunch. We understand that. But as Mr. Jeffrey correctly points out, you know, we have all had to tighten our belts. Now, under the circumstances, these are some of the things we need to do. But I agree with you. Sometimes it's wiser to actually build your own building than to rent. And if that's possible, then by all means look at it and see what we can do. I've had hands. Yes, first, Mr. J.B. Sivanyoni, followed by Kosi Olomisa.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe to follow your example, first of all, in Silva's comment, in view of the revolt in Northern Africa, I think they also need an education about the Makazi, someone between the king and the people, to advise what is the feeling of the people around. Yes. Public Protector, I used to listen to you speaking on radio in the past. Radio Palapala, Radio Frequency and the like. I'm looking at your accessibility and trust the achievement. I see you do speak about strengthening outreach, education and communication activities. I just want to find out to what extent maybe the Office of the Public Protector, do you have maybe opportunities to talk on radio that the people should phone you in and say, I'm having a problem about this and this, what can I do, and then you give advice on that. Does that happen, or you only speak once in a while when you get invited by radio? But more specifically, I'm thinking about community radio stations, that those may be an area to explore in view of the fact that they are easily accommodative when they get approached by person to say, can I use your channels, your airtime to talk to the community in this area and the like. I don't want to say I'm DJ. I'm a radio man.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. JJ is not here, but Jeff is here. Clearly, it shows that the traditional leaders are confident enough as the upholders of the rights of human rights to be able to invite the public protector to their place to listen to complaints that the women have against even their own use of authority. But this is a question that probably must have been asked and responded to previous engagements of the station. I may have not been there. But has the public protector considered the so-called Kata Asman what report on Chapter 9 institution and considered what your attitude is towards some of the recommendations. I'm reminded by the chairperson's remark that some members of the community of the office that should be housed under one building. As I understand it, that committee or commission has the idea that there should be one umbrella human rights board that deals with human rights violations from whatever quarter they come from. I'm just curious to know what the public protector's attitude is to the trust of the CADA they have intended to. I know, Chen, that it's a document that is supposed to be considered by Parliament. And the Parliament has still not done that, but I'm sure at some stage we shall have to apply our minds. But it would be good to hear what the Chapter 9 will be.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Ngozi Lumisa. I'll start with the last question around the asthma report. Yes, indeed, Honourable Member, we did look at the CADA asthma report, and it's something that we're constantly referring to. When we're looking at our reviewed mandate and looking at a operational environment analysis, that was one of the documents. And one of the things that the report says is that these institutions should collaborate more to leverage each other's strengths and weaknesses. And it is for that reason that we now have these forums, for example, in the provinces, where we try to combine our resources for the purposes of community outreach. But the point that you're raising is a more valid one and very helpful is how can we use each other's offices? That takes me to the question that was raised by Honourable Member Jeffrey about using LASA. Firstly, I would say that LASA is a good model when you are benchmarking the public protector. The Human Rights Commission is not a good model. Because I see, Honourable Member, you keep comparing us to the Human Rights Commission. You know, when people come and say, my human rights has been violated, it's more abstract than... So the number of people that need to interact with us are different from the Human Rights Commission. We're more like LASA, where people need a walk-in and just say, oh God, I don't know where else to go. Here's the real problem, is that they're not paying my social grant. I'm not getting my ID.
or my stand was given to someone else and they're giving me the runaround. So you need that direct contract. And it's not, but I'm not saying human rights are not important. I'm saying they're important, but the comparison is improper. I think the comparison ends at the fact that we both chapter 9s. But that's one of the mistakes government makes often, is that C9s are just seen as an amorphous thing, just as you can't compare us with the Auditor General, even though we are both C9s. But having brought in Lhasa, so I thought it's a good comparison because we're looking at that access, the kind of access, the model for access is Lhasa. We're benchmarking against them for access to justice. But we can't use them because we have the same requirement of independence as a court of law. Section 181, I think it's section 181.3 that talks to our independence. It's exactly similar to section 165.4 of the courts, independent, impartial, and answerable only to the law and the constitution. So it would compromise. That's why even to song we're looking at them, but we'll have to be careful. The post office seemed better because it's more of a parastatal. And we've seen it operating in Jordan. But even then, we have to look at those issues around, can people feel there's a separation between us and the executive? But Honourable Member, and going back to Honourable Member Olamisa, about being housed in the same building, though, I think that's an excellent idea. When I met with the Chief Justice actually said that was the vision, even with the constitutional precinct, that constitutional ill precinct, was that all of us were going to be there. Hopefully they wouldn't force us to go to Joburg and have to be stuck in traffic. But that's the vision, is that all of these institutions supporting democracy were supposed to be housed in one place. What has been difficult is been finding a place where we can do that. For example, here in Gauteng, our office is at Constitution Hill in the Women's Jail. You know, it's small, but we tried to achieve that model. And I think the model, Chairperson, that you are suggesting, which if government can take, is the model of buying. Because if you buy, then it's a shared building, and we leverage each other's communication as well, because the banners are just pushing them to one building, and if they don't get help in the one, they can go to the other. I think that we really should seriously consider traditional leaders with a conflict of interest. Again, there we wouldn't want them to receive the complaint for us. But we like the generosity of traditional leaders inviting us for our clinics and our outreach. And it has happened recently. We're in the Barolong, in the north, in the northwest. And the people complained against everyone, primarily against the traditional authority. But for us, that was where the Makati thing came in, because the whole council was there. They didn't, were not angry against the people. They were not angry against us. Well, the Honorable Inkosi knows the better. But okay. Well, what they suggested, which we agreed to, was we come back then and have a round table with the traditional leaders and the people and look at those complaints, because those complaints were very serious about, that's one of the richest communities in South Africa, and the issues were around equitable distribution of resources. So we thought it was a good opportunity. And Honorable Member Sibanyoni, you've raised the issue of radio. It's an area, Honorable Member, that we're trying to increase every day. That we haven't reached the point where we think we're doing enough of it. I'm going to ask Ms. Masibi to talk more about it. But it's an area where we want it to be like a standard practice. I know some provinces got quotations from some of the community radios to say, to give you a slot a regular slot, this is how much it would cost to, I mean, if you look at how much it costs us nationally to do certain things, it seemed to us that the community radio stations are much better. But we do try, when we have outreach, everything that we do when we have outreach, we also make sure that the community radio stations cover us. But in terms of the total map, I will ask Ms. Masibi, with the permission of the Honourable Chairperson, to talk to that one. I know that when resources are tough, we want to reduce expenditure. But Honourable Members, I indicated Honourable Chairperson that my view is that we need more regional offices rather than less. And our budget therefore needs more regional offices, but the location of those regional offices is something that we need to look at so that there's even distribution in the province. The Honourable Jeffrey raised last year the question of, have we considered travelling? My answer then, Honourable Jeffrey, is the same. We're not even considering it, we do it. That's why we have a mob service, that's why we have clinics, and it is in our report. But our people are oral people. The contact, the average contact, is important to them. As I said, for example, in Northern Cape, they often travel 400 kilometers, so they can't do that regularly. So it would be like they do two per month, not even to the same place, two per month. So that's good as an interim measure, but it is not good as a long-term measure if we want to use this model. I would want you to treat the Ombudsman Office or the Public Protector the same way as you perceive access to justice through the courts and say, what is the best model for this? But obviously not spending money in buildings if that's not necessary. Spending the money in providing the service itself. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
There's tea outside.
It's just an appeal that you do maybe relook at the Lhasa relationship, because a lot of their work is, I mean, somebody has a problem with their ID, they go to Lhasa. So it's not meaning that you become the same thing, but that maybe it is not such. If you're willing to share with the Human Rights Commission, where there is also a bit of an overlap, maybe there's not so much of an overlap. So it's not to try and resolve the debate here now, but it's more just saying a plea to say, look at it and think about it. And it's also not necessarily them doing your work, or not. It's not to them doing your work. It's basically a venue where people can come for the Public Protector to meet them. And if they come at the wrong time, they can still get sort of help and told to come back or whatever. Because I agree with you, I mean, we've got an oral culture. So the more human contact, person-to-person contact, the better. But it's not to have a debate now. It's more just to appeal to you to look at it carefully.
We didn't forget about you. So on a lighter note, I just want to use a point about the FUSA athletes who got me out of the office.
That's supposed to mean that people like me can't go to the
Thank you, Public Protector. Regarding using the radio or radio interviews to reach out, I'd like to mention that there are predetermined targets in our strategic plan, in our performance plan. For the current financial year, the predetermined target for provinces is to have at least 5 radio slots per province per annum, and to find a newspaper article. You will also notice that there are additional events per annum, and we leverage on those events. And mostly we hold events in rural communities, and our media strategy also targets community radio stations. Again, our interaction with the media, particularly the electronic media, is both reactive and proactive. In the reactive way, whenever there is an opportunity or we get invited, we never turn down the opportunity to talk on radio or to be interviewed. The public protector always makes time, even during odd hours, taking interviews as big as possible or as easy as possible, or just squeezing in to go and do the interview. And staff members as well who are conversant in other Zanika languages, every now and then when they request, we ask somebody who can speak a particular language to be interviewed on radio. Yes, I think I hope that answers the question.
Yes, I see the key ring between being given and lost. And it doubles up as a bottle opener. Is that appropriate?
No, on a slightly little more serious note, public protector, you know, we dealt with, Mr. Jeffrey will recall, RICA, which is the Regulation of Interception of Communications Act. And service providers were given a period of time in which to comply. And they were kicking against this and saying, no, it's too short. And on the one occasion, the Communications Committee invited us to be present, because now they were making a presentation. I forget the gentleman's name. He was a member of the SABC board. Jeffrey and I walked in, and there they were dishing out these very fancy pens. With respect to yours, very fancy. And so we were seated together, him and I, and we're looking at these and looking at one another and saying, they've come to persuade the Communications Committee, they must be given 3 years. And we were saying 6 months. Yes. So the first thing he did was, what's this? With a pen. Says, yes, I know, but why? What for? Well, everybody was seriously embarrassed, and the person representing Vodacom was at pains to say, but we always do this, and we said, oh, really? And then we were looking at the chair of the Communications Committee as if to say, is this what goes on here? Well, very proudly we said to him, yeah, take them back. Yes, we handed them back.
Yeah,
only the two of us. And the chair just intervened and said, look, this is not a committee position. If you want to give it back, you can give it to us. But we handed ours back, JB, and said, we're not impressed with what goes on in this committee.
Maybe just to say that Ms. Michael, who's a DA, used to be a member of this
Communications. So when you come with little bags with goodies, be careful. Your final word?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Chairperson, we didn't finalise the one issue about the Deputy Public Protector, but I take it that the committee said it will convene a meeting next week. So my office will then follow up with that. And we thank you, and hopefully
this time we will reach an immediate finality. Before I do my closing remark, I was just reminded by Mr. Mtetwa here sitting next to me that part of the budget we need, which is not in the budget now, is for this reviewed call center. Because we budgeted for just the review of the call center, but we need money for it. Because every time we go on radio, Honorable Sibanyoni, we get more people. And that's where then the staff even includes my office as part of the call center operator. Everyone is being immediately turned into a call center operator. But having said that, I think that is just to confirm that the Honorable Member is right, is that radio is one powerful tool, because even the poorest usually have some little radio of some sort, and they do listen to it. So whenever we have less money, we would rather go with the radio than newspapers or TV. We inject our money into the radio. So in terms of closing, I just would like to thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and Honorable Members, for the support and for giving us an opportunity once more to talk about where we come from, where we are, and where we want to go in meeting our constitutional obligation of investigating, reporting, and providing a remedy to improper conduct by the state, but in particularly to providing ready and accessible and affordable justice to our people whenever they feel they've been wronged by the state, whilst at the same time reconciling the state with its citizens. Honorable Sibanyoni mentioned, as if it's a joke, the whole question of what's happening in the north. I think we have said in IOMA, which is the African Ombudsman Mediators Association, which is managed by our office, we have said that we think countries with an ombudsman are more stable democracies. In fact, some study has been done within the auspices of the IOI is that countries with a functioning and respected ombudsman institution are more stable and have calmer citizens. And so, yes, and most of the countries in the north that had these appraisals had an ombudsman institution that was more of a decoy than a real institution matter. And I think for us, having a framework that allows us to be frank with the state, it does not just help the citizens, it helps us all as a country to grow and to sustain our democracy. But how do we do that? This is our request again to Parliament, is more resources. For investigations, we do need more resources. We will take all that has been suggested to us to continue to improve our own savings, our own smart ways of doing business. But in all fairness, we have 48 million South Africans. We have an institution that is, by all intents and purposes, a ministry on its own, but it's operating on a budget of 140 million. And people complain to us and that we're not giving them the prompt remedial action that we promised, and we're doing our best. As I've said, I have a dedicated team that works very hard, but we do need more resources. That's number one, Honorable Chair. The second request to Parliament is the request that I've made about continuing to help us to make the state comply, both during investigations and at the end of an investigation. At the end of the investigation, I would reiterate the request that ministers be asked to include in their annual report just a page that talks to if there were any investigations by our office, by the public protector, and any findings made against that ministry and what the minister has done about that. And from our side, we accept that we also issue a report that identifies very concretely which ministries we have made findings against and what has happened with the investigations. Because what's important for us is not just the remedial action, it's the sustainable change that we're talking about. Because some of the requests involve sustainable change. We will submit in this regard the report on in search of remedial action, a revised one, Honorable Chair, that really identifies the places where people have just said, we not implement, we don't agree with the decision, which nowhere else is allowed for someone to just say, I don't agree with the decision. They have to say the decision is irrational. But there has to be another authority that agrees with them, because then anyone can just do whatever they want, which is not what the drafters of our constitution had in mind when they provided an opportunity for South Africans to have access to services by the public. The last request, Honourable Chairperson, is we request the committees to seriously consider them the organogram. The blue has already been agreed. The part that we're requesting is red. Honourable Jeffrey, the blue, which is the regions, has already been approved. The only part that we're asking does not bring in any new regions. It's more the place where we are improving our compliance mechanisms and improving our investigation capacity. But even with the regions, I just wanted to say to Parliament, we can't close offices mid-term. That's why we have this comprehensive document that we're working on. And as it's become very clear that honourable members have very important and helpful views on this, once we've done that document, we will submit it on time and then request that this committee then gives us some insights, because obviously two heads are better than one, and I think we accept that. And we will then also discuss whether we use the post office model, or we use the LASA model, or we use the Tusong, or we use various models that include the traditional leaders, and to what extent do we use these without making people get confused about what is an ombudsman and how independent is an ombudsman. I think we'll accept that. And I just want to thank the team for being here. And team, you've heard from members of parliament that they don't want us all here. That's why they have a hierarchical organization, an organization that a few of us can be there. But we accept the offer by this committee that we will be visited by this committee at some stage. So we look forward to that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Public Protector, and thank you to the rest of your team, including the Deputy. We'll try and resolve the matters around that as speedily as possible. We won't go the route of the ad hoc committee. Trust me, ad hoc committees in Parliament, ask JB, he chairs one. It's the worst possible thing. Take 1 month, it's still with it for 4 months. Yes, and it's hard to split yourself in three ways. Yeah. Well, okay, but I think we'll just deal with it. Take it at Ketechwayo, we'll do it that way. Okay.
Maybe while after the meeting,
yes. All right. Or wins. Yeah. All right. My thanks once more to you, madam, and to the deputy and the rest of your staff. I think today's interaction was very good. And go well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.